Tamburlaine, Christopher Marlowe's play, is the first of those three plays this evening on BBC Radio 3. Well, there's been drama aplenty over the last few days through our coverage of the Leeds International Piano Competition. The result was announced last night. And this afternoon at 2 o'clock, Petroc Trelawney will be introducing the Prize Winners Gala Recital, featuring each of this year's six finalists in solo recital performances. That's at 2 o'clock this afternoon. And I should also tell you that the television coverage of it begins next Friday evening on BBC Four at 7:30. Of course, you can catch up with what you may have missed over the last few evenings via the BBC Radio 3 website. At 1 o'clock today, the Early Music Show and Lucy Skeeping will be presenting a profile of one of the earliest and best-known English operas, Purcell's Dido and Aeneas. That's in an hour from now. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's now just after 12 midday, and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The novelist, playwright and screenwriter Faye Weldon has written powerfully and provocatively about women and society, and in particular those trapped by the peculiarly patriarchal structure of British society. Amongst her many novels, Praxis was shortlisted for the Booker Prize in 1979, The Life and Loves of a She-Devil transferred memorably to the screen, Wicked Women received prizes and accolades in 1996, and her most recent novel, Habits of the House, about the lives of a privileged family at the end of the 19th century, continue, I think, Faye, many of the obsessions I've talked about. But I find your writing always very compulsive, and those feelings that you like to express, not just about women, but the way people interact in society, I get the feeling you have quite a lot of pleasure in writing. I mean, even though it's laborious, no doubt, but it's very perceptive and it seems to hit the nail on the head about people's behaviour.
Well, it is laborious and it needs a lot of rewriting, but it is sort of fun, and you get these sort of minutes of sort of understanding of what other people are on about, or you listen to what people are talking about outside, and then you write not about these people, but you get the feeling of what they're saying and manage to somehow, one way or another, put it into the fiction you're writing. So it's kind of true but invented at the same time.
You've always had a very direct approach to life and to people's failings and their qualities. I wonder where that all came from, and your fascination for the way women have evolved in the last sort of 200 years.
Well, I think perhaps I was brought up in New Zealand, and everyone is really very practical and to the point, and you can share a sheep and not make a fuss, and if anything goes wrong, you just cope with it and you assume things are going to go wrong. And I think this has somehow pervaded my entire life, so that you're both wary and aware of what is going on. You're aware of what used to go wrong. You're aware of what your grandmother said, what your mother said, how different they are, how your own generation speaks, how the other generation speaks, and can trace a kind of flow, and oddly enough, not just the way it changes, but the way it absolutely doesn't change, which is simply the same.
But I like the way you call a spade a spade. You don't dodge issues that some people feel uncomfortable about. You spell things out in a very natural way, actually.
Yes, well, I think perhaps I was never afraid much of what people said of me or said about me. So you just said what you saw. You report accurately and truthfully as you can. And if you are writing, that is your job, is to reflect, I think, the real world, not the world as we want it to be. I'm a bit didactic, I think. I kind of want everybody to behave better and do better and be good.
How did you fall into writing? Was it something you'd wanted to do since childhood, or because you did work for an advertising firm?
I did, yes. No, well, my mother was a writer, my grandfather was a writer, my uncle was a writer, and various other relatives, and they all earned a living writing fiction and novels, so it wasn't very exceptional for me to do it. None of us ever mistook it for art. It was just, you know, how we made a living and paid the rent. So there may be something genetic about it, or, you know, people would deny that, but I think there is. Just as a musician actually has a gift for music, understands music, lives with music, I kind of lived with words, understood words, liked words.
And quite a few writers have had a sort of genesis that started in advertising, because I imagine writing copy is not a bad exercise in economy.
Oh, I think it was an amazing training if you forget what you're writing about and it is selling. But in a kind of way, whatever you're writing, you are selling. You are selling ideas rather than product. And you're using the same skills, which is kind of brevity, the examination of exactly what you're saying, the examination of language very precisely. And when I worked in advertising, there were things called reading and noting tests in which whenever you wrote an advertisement, it would come back read, noted and categorised into various words which people had noticed, what they hadn't noticed. And you learn a great deal through that. And from other people rejecting what you say and saying this is all rubbish, and then you're humiliated and try and do better. And in the end, you know, you can deal with words.
I think there's one composer above all else that you favour when you are actually writing.
Oh, yes, and actually it's Handel, because it contains a kind of order, and yet it's not too disturbing. It's both nostalgic and a sort of waft of kind of feeling in the past and the celestial spheres and all kinds of things, and yet it's not disruptive in any way.
And this first piece is rather appropriate for where you are, where you spend a lot of your time in Dorset.
Yes, and we like sheep. I think my early fascination with this bit was the kind of the matter of punctuation, because it's just we like sheep, which is sort of rather strange. But then, of course, it goes on to the rest of the text. And
yes, you do have to do a double take.
But you do a double take, but it was a double take, I think, that always sort of absorbed me. And I love to hear them singing and re-singing we like sheep, we like sheep. And then only then getting on to the last bit, which is all we like sheep have gone astray, but you have to wait for so long to get to the have gone astray. No, I love it. It's both entertaining and lovely.
Maybe Handel himself was having a bit of a laugh.
Oh, I think he probably was. I think he did have a kind of sense of humour, didn't he? And always a sense of drama and a sense of narrative, but subdued in a way. I usually prefer silence, actually, but Handel does a lot.
Thank you.
And the mood changes, and act chapter changes, aren't they? And the sort of the smaller moods, like paragraphs, there never seems to me all that much difference between writing music, which I can't at all, and the way we put words together to follow mood and reflection.
And the way that contrast heightens the sentiments of both. In other words, if you put light next to dark, both become stronger as a result.
Oh, absolutely. Unlike putting too many adjectives in, when one adjective will take away from the other. But music does work in a different way, of course it does. But it's so joyous, and there's a sense of humour in it too, and this sort of levity, as well as a sudden sort of pathos and deep seriousness.
And that sudden moment of lyricism becomes so much more telling, doesn't it, after the rather more jaunty music of the opening.
Yes.
All we like sheep have gone astray. From part two of The Messiah by Handel, we heard the Monteverdi Choir, the English Baroque Soloists, directed by John Elliott Gardiner. I can't help thinking, Faye Wilden, that there is something in Wagner's own view of his work and the world that he creates that must appeal to you, knowing your work and your writing, and especially the sense of drama you have, which is quite idiosyncratic. And Wagner certainly had a very personal vision.
Well, I certainly think he's a great playwright. While I listen to the music, I really like reading the text. I love the stage directions. I love A Wild Place. You know, it could mean anything. Enter the Wanderer. There's a sort of wonderful romance and a sense of event and a sense of narrative and a sense of awe and wonder. And again, the sort of sudden lyricism. I mean, he seems the most sort of narrative of musicians to me.
And there's something mythic about it, too.
Oh, completely, completely. Everyone, especially in the bit we're going to hear, of sort of Erda, the heart of the earth goddess, and the sense of awakening and stirring and enormous forces coming out. And, of course, he has all these instruments and this sense of scale. I think it's wonderful.
I can think of several passages in your writing that might equate to this.
Well, I think that's wonderful. Thank you very much. I'm extremely honoured.
Thank you.
Music from Act 3 of Wagner's Siegfried, Erde Waking Up. We heard Hans Hotter singing The Wanderer, Maria von Illusve, Erde, and the orchestra of the Bayreuth Festival, conducted by Josef Keilbert. When you hear that music, Faye Weldon, do you feel that you are transported into somebody else's world in a very total way?
Yes, I think so. But mostly I think I'm thinking about Wagner and being in charge of all those instruments and simply being in charge of what is going on, which I suppose you feel as you're writing too, that you are kind of almost creating a universe and sort of trying to make it do what you want. And you always feel that with Wagner, I think, that there's a sort of sense of power and being in control and in charge, and it is another universe and you do go into it.
Leaving aside all these anti-Semitic arguments, do you think that, what you've just said, in fact, is why some people are quite frightened of Wagner, that he does exert a sort of power?
Oh, of course. He's too cosmic, really, for some tastes, and he's too sort of loud and too noisy and too big and too sort of earth-shattering and kind of would make you go and want to invade Poland or whatever it is, you know. But it is this sense of being pushed along by the music, I think, that does make people uneasy.
I think my reactions were, when I first sort of came to terms with Wagner, having to allow myself to submit to it, if you know what I mean, that you actually have to, and if you do that, then it becomes very invasive.
Well, I suppose he's very male in a way, isn't he? And so probably easier for women to go along with it than for men. But you would want to fight back, I can see that.
But I was pleased when I gave in.
Yeah, well, I'm glad. Because it's so rich and goes on so long.
Yes, so. I thought it would be lovely to get a taste of your most recent book. And I don't know, but I guess that the best place almost would be the opening, which sets it all up.
Well, it does. Well, it sets it up, so you know the sort of tone and the flavour. I wish it had the majesty of Wagner, but, you know, we are kind of doomed reality a bit.
Well, let's just hear the opening passage.
6:58 a.m, Tuesday, 24th of October, 1899. In late October of the year 1899, a tall, thin, nervy young man ran up the broad stone steps that led to number 17, Belgrave Square. He seemed agitated. He was without a hat or cane, breathless, unattended by staff of any kind, or office dress, other than that his waistcoat was bright yellow above smart striped stovepipe trousers, and his moustache had lost its curl in the damp air of the early morning. He seemed both too well dressed for the tradesman's entrance at the back of the house, yet not quite fit to mount the front steps, leave alone at a run, and especially at such an early hour. The grand front doors of Belgrave Square belonged to ministers of the crown, ambassadors of foreign countries, and a sprinkling of titled families. By 7 in the morning, the back doors would be busy enough with the deliveries and the coming and going of kitchen and stable staff, but few approached the great front doors before 10, let alone on foot, informally and without appointment. The visitor pulled the bell handle too long and too hard and worse again and again.
It reminds me of that passage, Faye, that you once wrote a pilot, didn't you, for Upstairs Downstairs?
Yes, indeed. Well, I mean, the kind of way, you know, somebody comes to the steps and you open everything out from there, and it's a good way of doing a beginning and how you introduce everybody you're going to have to deal with. And in a way, it is quite a sort of filmic book. I mean, not that it is written for television at all, but this is a way of writing that you open out and deliver a story and deliver a plot, which seems to me to be what readers take to nowadays, if only because they see so much film. But this is a book, it's very different, but you can use the same techniques if they work well.
Well, our next music, Faye Weldon, has a very strong filmic side to it.
Prokofiev, I always find, is again is so narrative and such fun and so lively, and actually this Lieutenant Kijay again comes from a kind of fault in punctuation, because Kijay is Russian for whoever, and I believe the Tsar mistook the phrase Lieutenant Kijay, which means Lieutenant however, missing out the comma, so he saw it as Lieutenant whoever. And Lieutenant KJ, he became, because you could never, never argue with the Tsar. So this whole great sort of myth around this soldier is built around this simple error at the beginning, and that always entertains me. And he's a naturally filmic writer, takes to it like a duck to water, and I take to him like a duck to water. And then you go back to Peter and the Wolf and the idea that it's children's music, which I suppose is kind of appealing, though it never was. But the sense, again, of character and the different instruments.
Well, and Romeo and Juliet, of course, which is so theatrical.
Yes.
This music, we're going to hear The Burial of Kije. Is that a movement you particularly like?
Yes, it's. I mean, most people go straight away to the sleigh ride, but this always seems, again, to have this sense, the sense of the other there, which is things untapped somehow, waiting.
Thank you.
It's the idea, isn't it, that just won't be put down.
There's also an extraordinary collision of worlds. He reminds me a bit of Ives in that piece.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking, of course, you've got Ives later, although yes. not the piece I'm thinking of, Three Places yes. in New England. You know, where he has those bands crossing,
yes.
and it's the sound you get. And there you get, as you said, rather beautifully, I think, a determination to have a good time, even when you're talking about a burial. Or so you get this sort of wonderful oom-buck suddenly emerges, and the spirits are lifted.
Yes, when life asserts itself.
It does. The Burial of Quiget, from Lieutenant Quiget, the suite opus 60 by Prokofiev. We heard the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Fritz Reiner. We're going to return to your favourite composer for working, to Faye. I wonder whether one of the things you get from this is something that I sometimes find. When I get very stuck, actually what I tend to do is to play Bach 2 and 3 part inventions on the piano. That something you said struck a chord, that in hearing a wonderful sense of order and a clarity of thought, I kind of often find that it lifts my spirits, it enables me to work again. Not because one compares oneself, because you could say that listening to Bach would be the last thing you should ever do if you're stuck as a composer, since you're being confronted with greatness. But you know, it's that thing about discipline.
Well, it's the metronome, isn't it, that insists that you keep it going and keep it right and keep to, you know, almost on what you've been told or what you know is what you're meant to be doing. And it just restores that to a sort of proper balance. And then you just continue as you had before, when you had been led astray, shall we say, into some nooks and crannies, and really you had no business going to anyway.
And I think it's also the thing of seeing how a great composer can, to use the Paul Klee words, take a line for a walk. You know, how he can develop something, and that reminds you that you can turn something upside down, you can extend something.
Well, indeed, and just listening to the Prokofiev there, you just get that sense of the enormous variety of human experience, and yet it is the same.
So the Handel that we've chosen is from that wonderful opera stroke cantata, oratorio, I guess we should say, Theodora.
Yeah.
Did you actually see this, or where did you encounter it?
Oh, no. All my childhood, I never saw any music, heard any music. I was in New Zealand, apart from my grandmother, who came from London via America at the beginning of the war, with her sort of style and her... She was a pupil of Clara Schumann and played the piano and had trained as a concert pianist, and
really?
That was all taken away from her when she married. But she still always played the piano, and she would come to New Zealand with this arable landscape of practicality and common sense and hard work, but would come with her trunk full of sort of bits of chiffon and sort of little shoes and this extraordinary ability in the piano, and she would play the piano 6 hours a day sometimes. And this was, in a way, one's musical education, but also a terrible thing that you couldn't play, you couldn't do music, you didn't understand it. She was all you had, and we couldn't listen to the radio even, so, because it was pop songs and polluting to the mind. It was a long time ago, I remember.
Do you think that witnessing this gifted musician being, as it were, silenced as far as the public was concerned, might have slightly coloured your feeling even then about the way women had to bow to family life or whatever it was they were doing?
Oh, I think so. And my mother was a feminist as well. And she too, you know, of an earlier generation, had been kind of stopped by, in fact, being a mother. She wanted to be a journalist and a writer, and she was a writer. But again, it was in the war. She was in New Zealand. The manuscripts would go over in a ship which would sink, and that was the end of it. So everybody in my life as women were being frustrated. So obviously, although by comparison, a very frivolous person, so they thought...
And Isabel Bailey, who we're going to hear sing, was, of course, someone who rose to the top of her profession.
Yes, and my grandmother would sing this song too. And again, in New Zealand, about angels, we didn't really believe in angels, and yet it was somewhere else. It was heavenly. It was somewhere you could all go to.
Thank you. It is beautifully sung.
It is absolutely beautifully and carefully sung. My grandmother would do it a little quicker. And poor Theodora was dying when she sang that. But that was somehow not totally in the music. It is aspirational in some way rather than...
But it has a melancholy to it.
But it has a melancholy. It's terribly sad. It really brings tears to one's eyes.
Angels Ever Bright and Fair from Handel's Theodora, sung by Isabel Bailey. Faye, we talked about Wagner in terms of cosmic energy. And it is now music that I think you feel is of the spheres, because we're going rather comfortably from Handel to Bach.
Yes.
And this is a cantata, 121, of which we're going to hear O du von Gott, erhörte Kreatur. What is it about this that you particularly love?
I think, again, it's a sense of order, of a sort of restorative order, that makes you indeed sort of realise what you're about.
It is sort of saying, isn't it, the man you cannot understand
what
you are.
Or take yourself seriously, almost. Or realise that what you're doing is actually important.
Fleisch, des Fleisches ein Erwerb.
The aria O du von Gott erhörte Kreatur from Cantata 121, Christum wir sollen loben schon, BWV 121, by Bach. We heard Kurt Equilus singing with Concentus Musicus Wien, directed by Nikolaus Arnoncourt. Faye Weldon, the next piece is indeed Ives, and we talked about that earlier. It's a very short piece, under a minute. It's a bit like a sort of haiku, isn't
it? Well, it is indeed. That's, yes. It's an unanswered question, oddly, which is, again, one of his earlier works. But it is almost the unanswered question, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it uses words of his own, Charles Ives wrote.
Well, absolutely. And it's sort of so short and so to the point and so sort of evocative of everything that he was and he wrote. Sort of enough, slightly anarchic, sort of oddly unprofessional, and yet extraordinarily sort of this musical energy which came out of him, which somehow is all contained in this sort of really odd 1 minute piece.
And all the more fascinating that this visionary musical mind was by day a kind of absolute, you know, bowler-hatted businessman.
Oh, absolutely, yes, an insurance man, that he did believe in universal credit, was it? I mean, he was a very, very moral person. And all through this, I think one has got the sense that there was this extraordinary link between music and morality, though heaven knows I couldn't say what it was. But the other thing about Ives was we went to visit his house in Danbury once, and on the wall was a letter he had written to his publisher, which said, "Dear Mr. Publisher, please don't alter a thing. All the wrong notes are right. Leave them as they are. They're what I meant." And also, sort of, when you're writing, you always feel this, that people are always trying to sort of make you write what is correct. And actually, this is not what you want. The wrong notes are right.
The cage. A leopard went around his cage from one side back to the other side. He stopped only when the keeper came around with meat. A boy who had been there 3 hours began to wonder, is life anything like that?
Such a delight.
I like the way he leaves the voice on its own at the end.
Yes.
Because that, again, is an unanswered question. An unanswered coda.
Yeah.
That was The Cage by Charles Ives. And we heard Susan Graham accompanied by Pierre-Laurent Aymar. Well, finally, Faye Weldon, we're going to have music which has a very personal connection to you.
Yes, it was written by my husband and, well, I just respond to it enormously.
And tell me about it, what it is exactly.
Well, it is a kind of revival song. I don't really know how to describe it, except it's God the Father, God the Mother, and it goes right back to the the heart of the earth, or this sort of fundamental female principle, which gets overlooked, but is there and terrifically powerful. And I think this actually gets to that feeling.
It may get overlooked in some places, but not in your work.
Oh, no.
Shine a light, shine a light.
it's the writing of the balance, I think, that one is after, in the name of the mother, somehow.
I think it suggests, Faye Weldon, that you and Nick Fox, your husband, have a meeting of minds, at least in one area.
Indeed.
We heard Miriam Stockley singing, and the musicians included B.J. Cole playing pedal steel guitar and dobro, Richard Brunton guitar, and Kevin Robinson flugelhorn, In the Name of the Mother by Nick Fox. Something on the jacket of Habits of the House, Faye, suggested to me that it's an ongoing project.
Oh, it is. It's a trilogy, and I've just finished the second, and the next one I have to do. But it just takes them over about sort of 6 years into what happened next, because you do get really interested. And you kind of want to know. You get the young ones and the happy marriage, and then, you know, what does happen next exactly.
So you are gainfully employed for the foreseeable future.
I am gainfully, certainly, yes.
Well, thank you so much for breaking into that for us, to introduce us into this music, which means a lot to you.
Thank you.
Faye Weldon was talking to Michael Barclay. Well, next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be Jo Wright, the award-winning director of the films Pride and Prejudice, Atonement, and the recent Anna Karenina. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and the producer of today's programme was Sarah Cropper.
Sibelius, the Second Symphony. Halle Orchestra and Mark Elder at Manchester's Bridgewater Hall on Radio 3, live in concert. Thursday night, 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Back to this afternoon, a very good afternoon to you. Welcome along to BBC Radio 3 from me, Ian Skelly, if you've recently tuned in. In just a moment, we'll be exploring one of the earliest and best known of English operas, a romance between the Queen of Carthage and her Trojan hero. Find out the name of the opera, if you don't already know, from that clue in the early music show in just a couple of minutes. Then we're live to Leeds, to the Great Hall of Leeds University, to hear each of the six finalists in the Leeds International Piano Competition playing a solo recital performance, all part of Radio 3's piano season. That concert is live here on Radio 3 at 2 this afternoon. But with the time now at 1 o'clock, it's time for a summary of the lunchtime news from John Shea.
Officials in eastern Afghanistan say at least 8 women and girls have been killed in a NATO airstrike this morning. A spokesman for NATO-led forces said they had been targeting militants in the area, but admitted there might have been civilian casualties and offered his condolences to the families. Earlier, 6 NATO soldiers, 2 of them British, were killed in separate attacks by men in Afghan police uniforms. The British soldiers were shot dead at a checkpoint in Helmand. In the second attack, 4 soldiers, believed to be American, were killed in Zabul, near the border with Pakistan. Ulster Rugby Club has paid tribute to the squad member Nevin Spence, who died with 2 members of his family in a farming accident at Hillsborough. His father is reported to have fallen into a slurry tank. Nevin Spence and his brother tried to save him, but all 3 of them died. Families of the 96 Hillsborough victims are meeting this lunchtime at Liverpool Football Club. They're planning legal action after a report revealed the extent of the police cover-up of the disaster in 1989. A man who exchanged gunfire with police officers in East Sussex is critically ill in hospital. The 62-year-old was shot after opening fire on officers in Seaford. Police were called in after a report of a domestic incident involving firearms. The former Defence Secretary, Liam Fox, has urged Conservative MPs to fall in behind the Prime Minister. Dr Fox also said talk of a threat to David Cameron's leadership from a group of backbench Conservative MPs was utter rubbish. Lawyers for the royal family will go to court tomorrow in Paris, seeking damages against the magazine Closer, which published topless photos of the Duchess of Cambridge. They also aim to prevent the magazine's parent company publishing further photos. and the weather. A band of rain is heading slowly southeastwards, with heavy showers in parts of northern England and North Wales, becoming increasingly light and patchy. It'll be largely dry in the southeast. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 1:02.
And that was John Shea. Our Sunday feature this evening is a profile of the composer John Cage in his centenary year. He's worked in many different disciplines, as you'll hear, from visual arts and the theatre to the written word and performance lectures. Richard Burness explores his legacy and beyond with the help of those who've worked with Cage, both old and young. John Cage, Beyond the Silence, is our Sunday feature this evening at 7:45. But next this afternoon, it's time to join Lucy Skeeping for today's edition of The Early Music Show.
Music by Henry Purcell, unmistakable, I think. The overture to Dido and Aeneas, performed there by Le Concert Spirituel, directed by Hervé Niquet. Today's programme we're devoting entirely to this, one of the most famous music theatre pieces in the whole early music repertoire. And although I'll be dipping in and out quite a bit to outline the story, we should get a chance to hear a good deal of the music because the whole thing runs for less than an hour. And since so much of it is well known, I thought it'd be nice to hear a variety of interpretations taken from different recordings across the generations, from William Christie's Les Arts Florissants to Colin Davis conducting the Academy of St Martin in the Fields and with John Shirley Quirk in the title role. I've also included a recording by the English Concert with Anne-Sophie von Otter as Dido, who sings that most poignant and most famous of arias, When I Am Laid in Earth, which, of course, we're going to hear at the end of the programme. I must admit, it does sometimes feel as if Dido's lament has eclipsed almost everything else in the work. But, of course, there's much more to Purcell's Dido and Aeneas than that. The first documented performance took place in or around July 1688 at a school for young gentlewomen in Chelsea, run by a prominent dancing master and choreographer called Josias Priest. Loosely based on Virgil's Aeneid, the story tells of the love of Dido, Queen of Carthage, for the Trojan warrior Aeneas, and her heartbreak when he's called away to battle. All pretty straightforward, you might think. And yet in some ways, Purcell's Dido is, as Churchill said about the Soviet Union, a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. For a start, is it actually an opera at all? It's certainly through-composed, so you'd be hard-pressed to call it a semi-opera like Purcell's follow-ups, King Arthur or The Fairy Queen, which contain a mix of songs and dialogue. But was it really commissioned for the Chelsea Girls' School? And since stylistically some of it sounds more like the kind of music Purcell was writing a few years earlier, was it really given in 1688? Some scholars have speculated that the idea actually came from the librettist Nahum Tate, who'd already written a play based on the characters and with whom Purcell had previously collaborated. But another theory is that Purcell was influenced by a somewhat similar work written just a few years before, Venus and Adonis, by his friend and mentor John Blow. Both pieces are similarly structured. Both call upon the chorus to perform various roles, and both incorporate dances to keep the story moving. And as for just where Dido was performed, well, we know that Venus and Adonis was originally composed for the court of Charles II and was later adapted for Josias Priest's school. So could it be that Dido was also originally given at court? And one more thing before I let you off. Was Dido ever performed again during Purcell's short lifetime? Well, we just don't know. And we don't even have a copy of the score written in Purcell's own hand. So now, on with the music. After the overture, we're in the royal palace where Dido's maid Belinda is trying to cheer her mistress's sad mood. Shake the cloud from off your brow, banish sorrow, banish care, she sings with the chorus. But Dido is tormented by her as yet unspoken love for Aeneas. Ah, Belinda, I languish till my grief be known.
Shake the cloud.